Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome. A few weeks back, I guess it was a couple of months ago, maybe 3 months ago, I forget, sometimes time just melds together, Dr. Lester Spence, who's a frequent guest in this program, was part of our panel that included Sheldon Eiffel and Melissa Harris Perry and Michael Eric Dyson, and we were discussing Manning Marable's book on Malcolm X in front of a live audience. And in that panel, and then after the panel, Lester commented that that day he said he was the only nationalist on the panel. I remember that very well. And that's led to a number of intriguing conversations since, both on the air and off the air. And this has always been a debate in America about what is more fundamental to our consciousness. Is it class or race, or is it both? We often hear on this panel and other discussions with refrains like, the black community, we have to do it ourselves. We can't rely on white folks. It's a black problem. We have to solve it on our own. And that's the way it has to come from the black street out. And that capitalism isn't a bad thing, but we need to get more people in it. Or that America is so racist that real unity can never happen, and that the divide may be class, but race divides that again. So, you know, whether you take it back to Martin Delaney or Marcus Garvey or as embodied by Malcolm X, is nationalism the answer to how organizing and how change has to happen? It's a complex situation. We cannot change the nature of poverty and racism, some people would argue, without a cross-racial class coalition that changes the nature of all this. So we decided to discuss that today. And Lester and I have been talking about that for a while. He's in studio with us here. He's on the show often. As I said, assistant professor of political science at Johns Hopkins University. And we're also joined by Jerome Scott, who is director of the Institute for the Elimination of Poverty and Genocide, who I have known for years as well. And Jerome Scott and Lester Spence, welcome both to the program.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Thank you. I'm glad to be on.
The number here is 410-319-8888. 410-319-8888 is the number here to join in on the conversation. So, Lester, I think that this is, and we really want you to join in here, because you know when we've had these discussions before, people have a lot to say about this. And so the question does become, when you look at this country and you look at what changes America or how it does change, what is the bottom line for both of you? To start in the broader sense, is it class? Is it race? Is it too difficult to separate? Lester, then we'll go to Jerome.
Well, so I'll complicate the story quickly, because last time we were on the show, the last time or time before that, we talked about how having a black representative wouldn't necessarily be the solution to the ills of black Baltimoreans when we thought there may be possibility that the next mayor of Baltimore might not be black. So I just like to complicate it that way. Now, in answer to your question, I think the question really is what's the best way to get people to organize around their issues in a way that will lead to further change, whether it's serious reform or it's even revolution. And I think that the best way to do that, given that we're already segregated by race and class, is to organize where we are. And that has to have a significant cultural component. And that's, for me, where nationalism comes in.
Jerome?
Yes. Well, I guess I take a slightly different take on this. I really think that it's a combination of both race and class. I mean, you can't deny the particular history of this country, which is a history of white supremacy and racism, but you also can't deny the particular history of this country, which is classism. I mean, class is probably the least spoken word when people talk about political reality than, you know, in this country than any other country in the world. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's a combination of economic factors as well as historic white supremacist factors. And, you know, I think that makes it fairly not easy but understandable where we should be doing our organizing and how we should be doing our organizing. I actually agree that we have to do our organizing where we are. And that's not the question to me. If you were in the black community, we have to do it there. If you're in a workplace where it's a multiracial setting, you have to do it there. Mm-hmm. I just think the kind of political education that one seeks to do when they're organizing should be one that deals with both class and race.
Yeah. So the question for me is how do we, And I was talking about this with Mark and thinking about it over the weekend because Mark and I happened to attend a really nice, what, like a 10-minute play event?
Right.
Yeah, but that one of your producers did an excellent job in. I was trying to think about how do we – your relationship to the means of production or your oppression is not sufficient for coming up with a new way, with a new system. It may be necessary, but it's not sufficient. So what is that thing that will allow you to both bind together with other people and to come up with alternatives? And that thing for me is culture, right? So we're organizing, or whether we're organizing specifically around class issues or specifically around race or gender or a combination of both or all three or whatever, it's like, for me, it starts trying to get people to understand the situation they're in, and then get them to use the tools that they already use to understand reality to then create this other thing. Does that make sense?
Well, I think that makes sense. I mean, obviously, for me, I grew up in Detroit and worked in the auto plants there, and, you know, was part of the League of Revolutionary Black Workers.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I guess in this day and age, everybody's from Detroit say they were part of that. But,
well, I talked to General Baker in June or July.
Yeah. And General Baker's a good friend.
Yeah.
And I know for me, what made me begin to think about the possibility of another world, another way of organizing society, was not until we as a grouping of workers in Detroit started studying theory, you know, and trying mm-hmm. to get a handle on what capitalism really is and learn, you know, the fact that capitalism has not always been here. You know, when you think about it, most people, because of our education system, don't realize that systems have changed over and over again in the course of the history of society. And it was only on the basis of understanding history and studying theory that I came to the conclusion, and we came to the conclusion, that another way of organizing society was not only possible, but, you know, probable, that we're moving in that direction. So that was the thing that clicked me into realizing that we could fight and actually win a better world.
Well, go ahead. Let's all jump in and say.
No,
go ahead.
No. Well, so if you take about, I'm from Detroit too.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
I didn't plan this. I want to let you
know. Yeah. Detroit in the house. So when I think about that moment in time. Now, obviously, I'm younger, right? So I was born in 69. This is what, maybe a couple of years after I believe Drum was created.
Right.
I think about Detroit. And what I think about is black workers in that moment, not just, they are organizing around issues of class. They are organizing as workers, but they're organizing also specifically as black workers, right? And you guys are taking the stuff that you're dealing with in the city along with reading, along with theory, in order to come up with the strategies and tactics that you use to take over the plants, right? I mean, so when I think about culture, I'm thinking about something a bit. So some of my colleagues might say that we need to go back to Africa, right? So we go back to Egypt, or we go back to these older ways of, or these older African modalities of being. I'm not making that claim necessarily, and I'm not making, even though I just wrote a book about hip hop, I'm not making a claim that we should go to hip hop or some other form of popular culture. But I am saying that there are these practices that that black people, because we're talking about black nationalism, that black people engage in, whether you're talking about Detroit or you're talking about East St. Louis or you're talking about the east side of Baltimore, that we can use in combination with other things to build this new way.
Yeah. See, I don't want people to take this the wrong way, but I agree with you. I mean, I think that you have to look at an experience and use your total experience,
mm-hmm.
you know, whether it's at the point of production or whether it's cultural experiences, whatever. I do think you have to use your total experiences, and you have to approach organizing from a total experience
yeah.
place, You know, so I'm not denying culture. You know, I think culture is a very, very powerful element in organizing and a very, very powerful element in terms of thinking about this world that we want to fight for and create. That, you know, culture plays a definite role and it's going to transcend this revolutionary process that we're involved in. You know, so yeah, we're not disagreeing on that. I'm just talking about for me, what made me realize, you know, that things could be different with theory.
Oh, yeah.
I didn't deny, or yeah, can I possibly deny, the other aspects of my life,
yeah,
you know, race or culture or any of that. It's just that's what made me realize that, you know, that we could make a difference.
Now, one of the things that most recently prompted this discussion was the reading and studying and conversations around Manny Marable's book on Malcolm X. And one of the things that happened in live audiences and also in the radio show are that people would say that you look at Malcolm X and you're trying to make him into a multiracial hero when Malcolm X was a black nationalist. And that's what he represented. And we can't change anything without that and that part of him and what he was. And so that, I mean, and to me, in some ways, that defines the dilemma, whether it is people who see themselves as revolutionary or people who see themselves as community organizers, people who see themselves as wanting to create more black entrepreneurs, however people will translate that. There's many ways to translate it. Mm-hmm. But that nationalist element has to be in it thicker than anything else if change is going to happen, if anything is going to get mobilized. And that's, I think, why I was using kind of Malcolm as the kind of core of what people like to argue over, that legacy, that thought. Go ahead, Jerome.
The one comment I would make to that is there's always part of Malcolm that is left off when nationalists talk about him or claim him. And that is, not only was Malcolm a black nationalist, he was a revolutionary black nationalist, which I think makes all the difference in the world. Because, you know, I am a firm believer that, you know, we have the kind of force that we need to organize in this country to actually create some significant change is so huge that we have got to figure out, as many of the different political divisions that we have, how can we work together? How can we see what we have in common and figure out how to make some common stuff happen rather than figure out what divides us? So I work all the time with revolutionary nationalists, you know, and I think there's some commonalities there that's going to take us all the way through this process. So that's one of the things I think about Malcolm that we have to include when we talk about who he was.
Yeah, and so and I take the complementary approach where, specifically in Manning's case, and I wish he was here for a number of reasons, but specifically in Manning's case, Manning has been kind of an anti-black nationalist since I encountered him as an undergrad at Michigan in the mid to late 80s, right? So when I'm approaching that text, for me, it's like Manning is specifically, at best, he's looking at black nationalism as this moment that Malcolm kind of passes through to get to the real stuff. Whereas for me, you know what I mean? I mean, yeah. Whereas for me, Malcolm was never, he was evolving and changing consistently. But I think that really is Manning reading his own, putting his own anti-black nationalist stuff in on, into Malcolm X. And given that we do under, I want to hit on something you mentioned earlier. We don't even teach class politics anymore. Right. Not in history, not in political science, maybe in sociology, where at least when I was an undergrad, I remember there being labor classes at Michigan. Right. So you're right. We don't talk about class at all. But to the extent we talk about ideological differentiation within black people, we treat black nationalism like a bald-headed stepchild. Right. And I think that's an understandable move. But I think that's a really bad political move.
I'm going to encourage folks to join us here at 410-319-8888, 410-319-8888. Just think of the world we're in, where no matter what city you're in at the moment, where you are, about how this fits into the everyday stream of what's going on, whether it's the reform of schools. You hear over and over again, and interviews we've done a lot over the last year about education system, at least a dozen times in the last several months, people commenting that segregation might have been bad, but we need an all-black school system for it to work. It was better when black folks were teaching black folks, and to make it a better world, people cared. So there's all kinds of ways to look at this. 410-319-8888. Join us here as we talk with Jerome Scott and Lester Spence. 410-319-8888. And let me define what that means. When you say that Manny Marable was a anti-black nationalist, what does that mean?
So I'll give it by way. So Michigan had our own student politics. We had a black population that was sizable enough to have ideological differences and real significant political differences. And there were black students and a number of other progressives who were straight up leftist. And then you had black students who were involved in black student union type politics, and we tended to be nationalists. And the leftists would consistently bring Manning Marable to speak. And during that time, we were really interested in bringing like Louis Farrakhan up, right? Who's a conservative, really conservative nationalist. And I'm really rail against that conservatism, but it is what it is. And every time Manning would come up to speak, it was like he would take the time to really rail against black nationalism, right? Now, he wasn't railing against conservative black nationalism, a move that I don't know if I would have understood then, but I appreciate now, and I make that same claim. He was railing against black nationalism, right? Making this argument that what we really need is this multiracial democratic move, as if you couldn't have both simultaneously, right? So when I talk about and you see that in the text, you see that in the text that he writes about Malcolm X a number of times, most notably when he talks about how Malcolm X didn't have the words to explain his African experience because his black nationalism wouldn't allow him to. And I'm like, that's crazy. That's empirically false, right? So that's what I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm. Jerome?
I had known Manny for a long time, and we had a really different sort of relationship. Like, I personally, I've talked to him a lot, and we've never talked about black nationalism. We had never talked about black nationalism while he was alive. So I don't have a whole lot to say about that. He didn't come off that way to me. But what I would like to respond to is this whole question of how you frame black nationalism. You know, and I think it's really, really critical. You know, just like, you know, black folks are not one whole, black nationalism is not one whole.
That's right.
You know, and if you don't deal with trying to understand exactly where I go back to the same point, where our commonalities are mm-hmm. within the nationalist community.
Yeah.
You know, and figure out, because, you know, one of the things that studying history and studying Marxism has taught me is that you got to figure out what's happening in the real world, and you have to accept it, and then figure out how to deal with it.
Yes.
Well, one of the things that's happening in the real world is black nationalism, and it's happening on different levels throughout that community, but there's a revolutionary wing to that black nationalism that is absolutely workable with, and we have to work with it. You know, I mean, we have to unite with it and figure out how we can carry out some work together that will move this process forward. So that to me is the most important thing to understand about nationalism.
So we went to this. I want to talk a little bit about this 10-minute play joint we went to. It was held. Where was it? It was like in a. It was. What was
it? In a warehouse.
It was held in a warehouse, and I guess we can't really talk a whole bunch
about it. The Bell Foundry.
Yeah, yeah. And I walk in, And it's like me and this other black guy, right? And they're like a whole bunch of people. And I joke to the black guy, like, listen, we can't be in the same place because if a bomb takes, they're going to take out both of us. And then conversely, it's like, you know, if the black energy, you know, if we stay in the same place too long, the whole place is going to blow up anyway, right? So I'm joking about that. I'm joking with Mark and his beautiful wife. And I'm thinking simultaneously, like, because the plays were powerful. Like, wow, if this was nothing but black kids, right, what would we actually see here, right? So it's not just about black nationalism as an ideological tendency that exists where people think of themselves as black nationalists. It's also the fact that we're talking about segregated communities that deal with specific types of stuff. And I was just thinking about, like, wow, what type of themes would we see if we were just looking at black performers and the audience was entirely black? And then how can we take that and use that to get people engaged in their stuff?
So if you look at that, and folks, 410-319-8888, Aaron, you're the first call. We're going to come to your call in 2 seconds here, in 2 minutes. But if you take that, a few weeks ago, a couple months ago, I was at a film opening, Bashi Rose, actor,
yeah,
has Men of Nomo, great, does this really good stuff, and he made this film that was built around a man's one act play about his life and his many characters and roles. The place was jammed, maybe 300 people sitting in the movie theater. 300 people, 5 folks were white.
Oh wow! Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
So that is the world we live in.
Yes.
And we live in a very segregated society, no matter where you are in this country. The few places you walk into that are multiracial, but it doesn't exist in most places. It's usually all black, all white. I mean, so that is how we approach it. So if that is how we approach it, does that mean that race runs so deep that only something like nationalism can respond to it?
Right. Oh, wow.
And see, I don't know if either one of y'all were at the U.S. Social Forum.
I was there, yeah.
Yeah, we were both
there. We were both there.
In Detroit,
oh,
baby.
That's right, you were there.
That's where I talked to
General Baker.
Right. You go to it. All right, then. Here you have a space with almost 20,000 people. And to me, it was the most multiracial place of 20,000 people that I've ever seen before.
Yeah, that's about right.
You know, and so what that says to me is that not only can we work where we are, where there might be, you know, all black communities, all, you know, even with integrated schools, you still have a lot of heavily, majority black schools in this country. But you can also have places where the multinational character of this country comes together as well.
Yeah.
And so I really think we have to think about working in both settings.
Yeah, that's right.
And I also, I don't know if I said this before, but I really do believe that you have to have a division of labor when you think about the vast work that needs to be done in this country. You know, we have to work where we are, but somehow or another we have to be able to talk across those lines and organize across those lines so we can have some coordination of our struggles.
Yeah.
And that's where I thought the U.S. Social Forum was so well organized, because it was some coordination in different communities that brought all those different communities together in that one forum.
Well, I mean, let me open the phones here. I have a question about nationalism in general. 410-319-8888 is the number here. And Aaron, you're on the air. Aaron, you there? Go ahead, man. You're on the air.
You know, when you talk about black nationalism, black leadership, in our city, we have none. We have a black mayor who could care less about the black and poor. It's more of a class thing than anything else, because you have these middle-class blacks who look down their nose at the poor sellers. And, Mark, when you talked about whether segregation was a good thing, if you recall, mayoral candidate Frank Conaway has stated that he believed that when he was going to school in the segregated school system, that he had received a better education than we received today.
Right.
And I happen to agree with him on that. And when you talk about, you know, the big thing was in 1983, as you know, because you worked in the same campaign I did with Billy Murphy.
Right.
And we thought that if we got a black mayor in this city, everything would be all right. Here we are 28 years later, and that's not the case. In fact, it's worse with the black mayor we have for the poorest of the blacks in this city.
And you beg a lot of questions here, I think, with what you're saying. And by the way, Aaron, you're going to have your chance on Thursday. The mayor's going to be on the show to ask your question. But that is part of the question. I mean, and it's part of the undercurrent of the debate in these mayor's debates, where Frank Conaway and others say in the debates that you need a mayor that looks like us.
Well, we talked about this. Is the last show you and I did. I mean, we talked about this, right? And I'm not making an elitist claim. There are a number of people making elitist claims about black nationalism or about other ideological tendencies, saying that we need somebody at the top to think this way, and then goods will distribute down below. I'm not talking about that at all. I didn't mention black leadership at all. I'm talking about black people. How do people organize? They organize where they are, right? I'm not talking about – I rail against the type of thing that would say we need a black mayor or a black X to do Y or Z.
But it's a very real feeling among a lot of people, Jerome and Lester, that in a majority African-American city, you have to have a African-American mayor. You shouldn't be electing white folks to the office. Or – let me throw one out here. We can take a break, come back in Preston, in Bowie, the next caller up, so don't hang up. We're going to come to your call and the others at 410-319-8888. Or at this station here, WEAA, which used to stand for We Educate African Americans, now it's We Educate All Americans, is an African American station, and I'm here, and there are some folks who don't like the fact that I'm here. Right?
I don't like. No, I was just joking. <You're> joking. I love the show.
But all that is real.
Yeah, that's real. That's real.
So, but and nationalism and that pride that comes and the power that comes out of that is real. And that, you know, if you look at nationalism, always comes out of oppression, whether it's Jewish nationalism or black nationalism. Whoever it is, you know, that it comes out of an oppression and takes a life of its own, and has, because people say that's the only way we can respond to the oppression. So let me come back to that. I said a lot. So let me take a break here and come right back to that. Preston, we're going to come back to you. Thoughts and questions and the issues I just raised here. We're here with Jerome Scott and Lester Spence talking about nationalism, its place in our society today, what it says to the future of the black community and to the America as a whole. 410-319-8888 is number here. On the way to break, I have to remind you something. The WEAA is proud to be a media sponsor for Thursdays at the Lewis, presented by the Reginald F. Lewis Museum. Thursday, August the 18th, features the Latin jazz sounds of Duende Quartet, 5 to 8 p.m., hosted by WEAA's Guillermo Brown. The Reginald F. Lewis Museum is located at 830 East Pratt Street in Baltimore. For more information, 443-263-1800 or AfricanAmericanCulture.org. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner, and the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by Urbanite Magazine's new e-zines. It's a simple way to stay connected to the topics and events you care about most. Daily content on arts, culture, food, design, style, green living, and much more can be delivered to your inbox. Registration is available at urbanitebaltimore.com. We're talking about the place and relevance of nationalism, black nationalism, in our world today, in America especially, as we battle for the future of this country. We're joined by phone by Jerome Scott from Atlanta, director of the Institute for the Elimination of Poverty and Genocide. Here in the studio, Dr. Lester Spence, assistant professor of political science at Johns Hopkins University, and his new book is called Stare in the Darkness, The Limits of Hip-Hop and Black Politics. 410-319-8888. Before I come back to my thought, let's go to the phones in Preston, in Bowie. You're on the air. Hi, Preston, you're on the air.
Hi, I'm glad you're having this discussion today on this topic, and I just want to get right to it. I think the black and black nationalism is problematic because it's hard to rally around. We're too multicultural and multi-ethnic today, and as soon as you I mean, black folks, we haven't even been able to agree whether we wanted to be called colored, black, Negro, African-American. And so I say, you know, the fact that the black nationalism movement hasn't taken off the way that we would expect it would have is an indication that it's, I think it's in the title. In, I think we get so hung up in what we call the thing that we don't do the work. You know, people need political equality, economic equality, health care, financial literacy. We live in capitalism, and people don't even know how to make capital work. And so I say, let's get off of the name and get down to the work. And Malcolm, I think the most redeeming thing he left with us was when he said, no permanent friends, no permanent enemies, only permanent interests. And we should just do the work and be willing to have coalition with all other people who are willing to do the work.
Jerome?
Well, actually, there's a couple of things. I definitely agree that we have to get down to doing the work. So let's just put that aside. I don't think you can ignore dealing with the political side of the process. You know, that there has got to be some political education and some political discussion that makes us understand how we can unite with each other. We can't just say, let's go do the work. We have to say, okay, how do I want to do the work? How do you want to do the work? What is the work itself that we're going to be doing? And I think that takes education, that takes political discussion, and, you know, we just have to be about the business of trying to understand the world as it is and not assuming that we get it because we don't.
Yeah, that's it. That's it. And too often, and this is and we have a tendency to say that this is a black thing. It's not a black thing. It's a people thing, right, where we don't – and it's a people thing that's produced. It's a structural production where we tend to think that politics is just about voting, or to the extent we have politics, it's a bad thing that kind of signifies that we've got dysfunction. And politics is a natural part of this process, and it takes a long time. Organizing takes a long time. You and I may agree on a wide range of issues. That doesn't mean we're going to necessarily agree on how to get there. That doesn't necessarily – and if you even deconstruct what the thing is we're agreeing on, you'll probably find places of a disagreement. So that's the thing where there's no substitute for organizing and, you know, hitting back on a cultural thing. That's where we can use kind of cultural spaces to create that the educational – to make education more possible, to make discussions more possible. Right. So you take a group like Public Enemy, who's in some way their politics are conservative in some way. You know, there are a whole range of people or issues they're talking about that the kids growing up listening to them would never have been made aware of them had it not been for listening to that piece or to their work.
410-319-8888. And Preston, thanks for the call. 410-319-8888 is the number. Jay in Middle River, you're on the air.
How you guys doing? I wanted to ask the panel this evening, what role do you think socioeconomic status has in the nationalism discussion? Because if you look at all facets in our culture, whether it's music, whether it's entertainment, sports, anything you want to talk about, how much money you make has a lot to do with how you advocate and how that dynamic is split. So I wanted to get you guys' thoughts on that. Thanks for taking my call.
Interesting question. That's a really interesting question. So I know you're nodding your head. Yes, the interest in Lester, but I'm sure Jerome was as well.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
No, I'll let Jerome go first. I'll go.
Yeah. It's like I started this conversation off with. I mean, we cannot disregard either the economic side of our being or the racial side of our being. What we have to do is figure out how the class dynamics and the race dynamics play together and how we can organize based on both of those things and not deny other things. You know, like, but in direct answer to his question, of course our socioeconomic status has a lot to do with how we view the world. You know, I mean, your worldview don't just come from the history, although history plays a big role in it. But your present situation and your economic situation plays a huge role in it too. Not that you can't overcome it, you know, because a lot of people have committed class suicide and mm-hmm. and joined with the workers to fight for a better world. But you do have to take those things into account.
So, brother, so when I talk about, so the last two callers touched on this. When I talk about, or when we both talk about organizing where you are, I think there's a working class component to it in that. So the challenge of the cultural argument that I'm trying to make is that the cultural apparatus itself has an economics to it, and you've got people with power, people with resources who control the economic apparatus. Where you're talking about comic books, like we talked about the other day, or you're talking about movies, or radio, or you know, albums, or whatever. But if you talk about, if you give people, or if people organize where they are, you know, again using that play example, where you've got, if you've got working class kids, or you've got kids from these neighborhoods creating their own stuff, then you kind of control that class out of it, because they've all got the same basic means of relationship to the means of production. So within racial groups, you've really got to deal with class. Class becomes really important, because otherwise you're going to have these big shots calling the shots. But then across class groups, race comes into play, where if you're not careful, you know, you're talking about black working class groups organizing with other working class groups, their interests as black people get subsumed. So, yeah, you have to deal with them kind of simultaneously. And the best way to do that is starting really, really, really local, really intensely local, and then building outwards.
I mean, some people could argue, though, that the whole idea of interracial movements, multiracial groups coming together, is mythology. I mean, I know what happened in the Social Forum in Detroit and other social forums, but going back to what we were talking about here, and what it was on this program a little bit ago, in Baltimore or in Detroit or in any other city that is majority African American, let's say, there is a huge body of thought that no. There's no way that somebody white should be mayor of a city that is majority African-American or majority Mexican or majority whatever. Mm-hmm. And the nature of oppression has created that well of feeling, and it's huge and deep. So how does that fit into that picture?
And here is the problem with that, okay? I mean, if you look at any of these major black cities that have elected black mayors, and then you look behind it and see what are the forces controlling not only the black mayor, but the mm-hmm. political and economic and social system behind it, you'll find that white folks are right there anyway. White folks, you know, you look at Detroit, you know, the auto industry played a critical role in the economic development of Detroit. And it played a critical role with the economic degeneration of Detroit once Coleman Young got elected. Mm-hmm. You know, so even though we elected someone black, that's only the political side of it. We have to also look at the economic side of it. You know, and a little of that has happened in every city that have elected their first black mayor. You know, the economic situation began to deteriorate the moment the black community took over the political side of the equation, you know, and therefore you look at just about every major city, the plight of black folks in those cities that have black mayors have not fundamentally improved, and in many cases they've deteriorated. You know, so even just saying, you know, we don't deserve, and I actually take the position that we do need black representation in all our elected bodies. So I'm not taking that position. That's the side that I think you have to unite on. But you have to also be prepared to hold those black elected officials accountable to the community that they come from. You know, and that's the side that I don't think we've organized up to.
Yeah.
Holding that accountability.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. Right. So if you think about the whole idea of taking, you know, starting where we are, right? So we're in a place where, again, because of segregation, because of a number of different reasons, black people want and need representatives that look like them, right? It would be – I actually supported John Edwards in the primary when he was in it because I thought that he was more leftist than Obama. But if he wasn't there, I would have just supported Obama. If I had the choice between two evils, I'd have gone with Obama because he was black, right? So that's where we are. So the challenge for us – is to say, okay, this is where we are. What's the next step from this, right? So one of the arguments that Kwame Ture, makes this argument in the 25th edition or anniversary edition of Black Power, where he said, well, our challenge with Black Power is we didn't sufficiently moor our concept of Black Power to like standards of accountability. That was the next step. And that, so you take that, that desire to vote for somebody black, and you're like, okay, yeah. Then you work hard to attach that. Like, okay, if somebody is black, then that means they need to be more accountable to us, right? And then you build outward from there. So it's not necessarily that that's a bad or problematic step. It's a matter of us recognizing and reinforcing that that is a step. It's not the be all end all.
So,
and the only other thing I would add to that is that it's sort of like your question, you know, can multiracial formations actually exist? When you think about it, once those black mayors got elected, then there became a battle of who they're going to actually represent.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whether they're going to represent the community, low-income working-class communities where most of them came from, or whether they were going to support the business community, and it was an organizing effort on the business community that surrounded those black mayors and brought them in to represent them.
Yeah, so in effect, they had a multiracial coalition, right?
That's
a multiracial coalition there.
That's my point.
Yeah.
They had a multiracial, and they have.
Yes,
right,
and they have
in every major city that
yes.
has black mayors.
That's right.
Well, I'm curious when you look at urban areas and the majority of in most urban areas, within cities, the dispossessed are overwhelmingly people of color, in urban areas.
Right.
And that since the deindustrialization of America, that has grown exponentially, numbers of people living as the dispossessed with nothing left behind. And so, and at the end of segregation, there was this window, and a whole bunch of folks jumped into what people loosely call the black middle class. So the question is then, given where people are now, the situation people find themselves in this economy, and also in the state of inner cities, the state of our schools, the state of health care among poor people and the rest, the state of families in urban America, so who's the us?
From my perspective, I don't know how many people have saw that the recent study on wealth in America today,
mm-hmm.
in which they really, you know, like the wealth that black folks and Latino folks had acquired
is
over
gone.
The last 30 years, basically.
Yeah, it's gone.
You know, in this last economic depression that we're experiencing right now, you know, the black and Latino communities were the most affected by this economic downturn, to the point where we lost anywhere from 50% to 60% of
yeah.
whatever wealth our community had obtained
yeah.
over the last 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
What that tells me is that the whole situation of the black middle class or the so-called black Latino middle class is so tenuous that all it takes is one major economic downturn, and many of us who thought we were in that so-called middle class are right back where the us exists. So the us to me is those people who have very little wealth. A lot of us have no wealth whatsoever. It's the working and poor people of this country, which, by the way, if you think about it in percentages, a large percentage is people of color, black and Latino. But if you think about it in numbers, the vast majority are white folks
so,
that have no
wealth or you know, are part of the dispossessed. So I think of that section of society as being the us.
So the other question is, so I look at that question as the who. So the other question is the when, right? I mean, not the when, but the where, right? So if you go back 40 years into Jerome, to General Baker, to people like my dad, it's like the where wasn't just cities necessarily, but it was plants, because that's where the people were, right? That they're working in these huge plants. The plant, my dad worked at Rude Steel. That they had as many people in there than most major Michigan cities, right? But the where now, because these people are unemployed, is a bit different. I would argue that the where is actually in schools and in neighborhoods, right? In schools, because you're talking about these places that have literally, in Baltimore case, like some hundreds and thousands of people there, predominantly Black, predominantly, I don't know about the administrators, but you're talking about a predominantly Black body, right? And then the neighborhoods that are segregated, right? So it's about the who, but it's also about the where. And I think it's that, I think it's combining those two, you know, the who and the where, that gets us a little bit, I mean, we still got a lot of work to do, but it gets us a bit closer.
Right.
Let me go back to the phones here. 410-319-8888 in Haki in Baltimore, you're on the air.
Yes, good evening.
Good evening, welcome.
Yes, a BB48. Yes, well, I have to say that, you know, interesting conversation. I, you know, thoroughly enjoying the discussion. You know, when we talk about Black nationalism, and I don't know if it has been discussed, but, you know, the issue of reparations absolutely must come up and it must be centered. I give you this example, and you know, someone's mentioned something about, you know, the politics in Baltimore, or politics in general. For instance, there was a major reparations rally some years ago. I believe it was close to 2005, where many nationalist groups marched on Washington, D.C. to address our just demands for reparations. And, you know, there was a mayoral campaign, I believe, like somewhere around there, where Carl Stokes, Catherine Pugh, and Sheila Dixon were running for office. And it was real sad that none of them actually even, it never came up during the discussion. And I just think that how, you know, how far many folk are so far, I mean, it should not even be a discussion on whether Black people are deserving of reparations in this society today. You know, when many of these other ethnic groups, the Japanese and the Germans, have received reparations. And so, you know, I think that, you know, we're going to have to demand it, and it's going to be absolutely, it's going to be done, you know. And so I think that logically we have to push for that as an agenda and objective. I'll take whatever you have to say off there. Thank you.
Interesting, Haki. Thank you so much. Let's wrestle with that one for a minute.
Well, look.
Jerome Scott.
If we look at the history of Black folks in this country, we have to recognize that slavery was one of the most profitable entities that ever existed in terms of exploitation in this country. You know, slavery was a very profitable organization of Southern society. And all of that wealth and all of that value that was accumulated by the United States, none of it, not a penny, went to sustain Black folks in any way, form, or fashion. So if you're talking about reparations for what was taken from us, what was exploited from us, then yes, I mean, I don't think there's any argument there at all that there should be some understanding of how do we organize society so that the amount of value that has been exploited from Black folks can be given back to them. Personally, I think that struggle is connected up with our struggle against capitalism in general. And those reparations will come as a result of our reorganizing society away from a capitalist structure.
Nothing? What are your thoughts about reparations?
So the challenge is, first, there are ways to organize around it that deal with where we are now, right? So you've got a number of instances of, like, we know, for example, in a number of cases, land was taken from Black Southerners, right, but still living black Southerners, and that was transformed into profit-making entities. And we know where those black people live. That's a move that we can not easily, but I mean, that's a straightforward tie. My challenge, though, is that, and this is what gets to the top-down thing. It's a significant detail to figure out how something like that would be administered that wouldn't, in effect, reproduce this top-down dynamic within black communities that we fight against anyway. Right. So we get reparations. And then what happens? We have to have some body of black people who determines who gets what. Right. And I think within black communities, that's the biggest struggle we have to wrestle with. Right. Where there are these black people who have resources, including the ability to determine who is and isn't black. And they hoard their stuff without mechanism of accountability from the rest of us. I don't know how we deal with the reparations issue. And deal with that. I don't know how we do it.
Well, that's why I said that it has to be part of our organizing effort.
Oh, just in general. Yeah, that's right.
If we leave it, you know, they could give us reparations tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
And if we leave it to the structures that we presently live in, then those structures are going to be discriminatory.
That's right.
They're going to cause more division within the black community than not getting reparations if we leave it to be done the way we're organized now.
Yeah, that's right.
But so I'm curious, as we close out here, at least for this conversation today a little bit, the relevance of black nationalism in the body politic of America today, given that in huge parts of the black community there's absolute distrust of the white world and what the white world has done. And that racism still runs deep in this country. It hasn't gone anywhere. It's kind of in some ways more subtle. In some ways it's pretty blatant, and it depends where you are. But it does run. And you can see it just in some of the attacks on Barack Obama and other things that he, because he personifies it now for some folks. So how does the stuff that you start off with here, Lester, even getting this conversation going today about the relevancy of black nationalism, how does that fit into that?
I don't think there's as much mistrust of whites as there used to be. I'm not making an attitudinal claim necessarily. But what I am suggesting is that hypersegregation, that is segregation by race and class, has gotten worse, and probably given the crisis, given the numbers Jerome mentioned earlier, will become even more worse. And it's really and in as much as there is no, you know, to the extent we once had this radical black space to talk about political stuff, that space is gone. The only place or the only way we can reconstitute it is if we get black people community by community to use that stuff they have those conversations. So to that degree, black nationalism has to be part and parcel of any attempt we make to kind of rebuild this world.
And a final thought, Jerome Scott.
Yes, and I really, you know, there are problems that we face as a black community that are more severe than other communities. And I think, maybe I'm mistaken, but I think when some people say black nationalism, they think that if you say that we have got to have policies that hits the inner city squarely to relieve some of the problems that exist in the inner city, then that makes us a black nationalist, or does that make us a realist?
Yeah.
That there are problems that exist in the black community that have to be dealt with directly, you know, and not from any other sort of obscure place. And if that makes people think that you're a black nationalist, then I just think you have to deal with that on a reality basis. You know, that's part of our thinking. That should be part of our organizing.
Yeah.
And you know, I think that if you do that, then you set a stronger basis for our organizing to be successful.
Yeah, that's right.
I'm going to thank you both for taking the hour today. Jerome Scott, good to have you on the air. Thank you so much.
All right.
Look forward to having you back on. Lester Spence, thank you so much.
Oh, thanks. This has been a great show.
And when we get you back, Lester, we got to jump into your book, which we have not done yet, Stay in the Darkness, The Limits of Hip-Hop and Black Politics, for an hour.
With that.
All right. Thank you all. And we're going to take a brief break and come back. I want to remind you, on the way to this break, the Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the University of Maryland Marlene and Stuart Greenebaum Cancer Center, an NCI-designated cancer center providing research, treatment, and education to further the prevention of and cure of cancer. Online at www.umgcc.org, or the number for more information is 1-800-888-8823, and their banner is on the Steiner Show website. You can click on and get all the information there as well. We'll be right back. Stay with us.